Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to focus a little bit of our attention on soil. You know, good soil, it's the foundation of a great garden, and we'll be talking about how to create healthy soil with our guest today, Kevin Chesso, back with us once again. He's actually in our studios in Superior. He's the area ag development agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for the Tri-County area. He manages the teaching and display garden at the Spooner Ag Research Station, and he organizes horticulture workshops and field days. So great to have him back. We'll talk about improving garden soil. We can talk about planning for next year's garden, take your vegetable and gardening questions. We can also talk about fruit-bearing plants as well. Love to have you part of the conversation, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Kevin Chesso, welcome. Great to have you back with us. I think.
Yeah. Hey, good morning, Larry. Thanks to be here. Yep. Hit the wrong button.
Oh, well, I do that every once in a while myself. So it's great to hear your voice. And, you know, I mentioned when I was introducing the show, you often talk about adding more and tilling less. That's your philosophy when it comes to soil.
Yeah, I've kind of developed that tagline over the years because I think it really is something that captures what, in essence, we should be thinking about when we're managing our soil. And basically adding more is, you know, on the organic matter, and till less is that physical distribution or disturbance that we do to the soil. So that's just kind of a catchphrase. There's lots of different, concepts and points about how to have healthy soil, and that just sums it up in a real nice tagline.
You know, as you think about organic matter to add to the garden, what are your favorites?
Well, I'm a real fan of using local sourced organic matter that we all have in our backyards, and the primary one for me personally in my gardens is leaves. You know, we've got deciduous trees, and I live in the city of Spooner, so I have a city lot, and I'm amazed at how many leaves just fall on my little backyard area that I rake up, and there's my supply basically for the whole year. Use it for compost, I use it for mulch, so that's my primary source, but everybody's got different situation, and you've got to be creative.
Yeah, I wind up with more leaves from other people's trees than my own, but they are a constant source of organic matter.
Well, of course, and again, it's free, it's right there, you know, and I know not everybody has got the time and space to manage that big pile of leaves that you collect in the fall, maybe several times in the fall, depending on how often you rake, but I just don't want to see all that good carbon be put on the street curb and hauled away someplace else. I want to keep it on my property and enhance my soil with the stuff that's right there. You know, I got to rake the leaves anyways. Most of us do. So why not take advantage of it?
You know, Jeffrey in Mauston has something for us. It kind of, I think, fits in with what we're talking about right now. Jeffrey, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I just purchased some property north of Mauston, and we live out in the country. And we have an overabundance of blueberry resembling plants with long-running roots. They're growing about 12 to 24 inches tall, and they are everywhere. And I'm not quite sure what they are, and we want to plant a garden this year, and we live in a wetland and highland area, and what vegetables would be more suitable to that type of soil?
And so this is a brand new garden. Nobody's been gardening in this spot before. For, at least to your knowledge, Jeffrey?
No, we are the first people on this property.
All right.
All right, so starting with a clean slate, of course there's a lot of variables that need to be taken into consideration when we make planting decisions, and, you know, I'm going to just jump right to, obviously, you've got to clear the spot so that it's appropriate to plant vegetables and make that space available. But once you kind of get that space identified, the very first thing that I'm going to advocate is to get a soil test done and start with that chemical analysis so at least you know where some of those basic plant nutrients are, and the pH being the most important. And then, of course, we've got the other macronutrients that we know plants need. And a soil test will give you that information, and at least that's a starting point, because we really need to be aware of, you know, that soil condition, and pH is probably the most important. So definitely start with a soil test, and then it's just a matter of how much do you want a vegetable garden. I'm a big fan of raised beds, of companion planting, square foot gardening, if you will. I don't like to till up a big space and plant long rows, kind of like my grandparents did. I'd rather see the plantings done in smaller areas so you're not compacting the soil and you can amend it and, you know, getting back to that add more, till less concept. That's how I like to plan a garden, is, you know, draw it out on paper and what might it look like. And, you know, if you've got a really heavy, wet soil, raised beds will eliminate some of that moisture problem. You know, sandy soils, there too, adding a lot of organic matter in a raised bed format is going to increase water holding. So I would just start with some basic concepts related to, you know, getting that soil prepped. And then when it comes to choosing your vegetables, I think, you know, in some ways the sky's the limit. You can choose whatever is going to fit for your personal preferences. And then, of course, you got to keep in mind, you know, the length of growing season and how long a maturity you have to mature certain plants, and then the space requirements. So I don't know if that gets you started.
And Jeffrey, if you when you do your soil test, and we can talk a little more about how to do that, but when you send in your sample, what a good thing to do is say, I'm going to be planting a vegetable garden in this area. And sometimes they will say, give you recommendations on maybe what vegetables work and which ones won't work as well for the area. Is it, if I'm not mistaken, is that right, Kevin?
Yep. It's all right there on the information sheet. And it does matter because, you know, the results you get back don't mean anything unless there's a research-based interpretation that comes with it. And that's exactly what all the, you know, years of university research has done in interpreting the soil test results for whatever crop you're growing.
So where does Jeffrey go to get the information on the soil testing?
Well, nowadays, I think most people have access to the internet, whether it's through a smartphone, an iPad, or a computer. And I just go to a search engine, and you can type in soil testing or soil testing lab, UWEX, and that'll take you to a number of different, you know, sites, and there'll be all the information you need on how to collect the sample, how to fill out the information sheet, where to send it. I'm advocating, of course, that we use our UW-Madison soil testing lab at Marshfield, but there are other places, other state-certified labs you can send it to. So internet's a good thing if you can navigate it.
Jeffrey, does that help out?
Yes, it does, very much. And back to the little blueberry plants that resemble blueberries, we don't necessarily, well, we certainly don't want to disturb anything of our natural flora here. But if you could, you know, without seeing them, it may be hard to tell us what they are, but these little plants, they're shrubs, and they grow about 2 feet tall, and they're concentrated in areas on the highest parts of our property. And like I say, they resemble blueberry plants, and they have long running roots. We pulled a few up, and those roots are longer than they grow tall.
Huh. Hmm. Yeah, it is kind of tough to diagnose or to identify plants over the air. Obviously, you know, that's where a picture. And I'm not, you know, really good on all my native type plants that would probably naturally be growing in, you know, in your wooded areas. So, what I would suggest is if you're able to take a picture of it, and now we don't have any leaves, of course, and all that, you know, diagnostic stuff is off the plant. But, you know, pictures can certainly get us a long way in identifying all kinds of things, from diseases to insects, you know, to plant parts and all that. You know, so a picture is worth 1,000 words. If you can get a picture and send it, you know, you could send it, you know, to me, and I could try to take a look at it. Otherwise, you know, most county extension offices or area offices might be able to help you out in doing that. But you can certainly send it up to my email in Spooner, and I can take a look at it. But again, there's not a lot to look at this time of year.
Yeah, when it gets some leaves, yeah, it's always good to take sort of a little bit longer shot so you see the whole plant, and then a more of a close-up where you can see sort of the branch and the leaves themselves closer up.
Right, and the concern here is this an invasive plant or a non-native that you really want to be aware of and manage?
Yeah.
But if it's just naturally growing, it's just what Mother Nature has out there, you know, leave it be, enjoy it. You know, if it doesn't cause, if it's not causing problems, you know, you just have to accept that it's there.
So to get to you, mm-hmm. Kevin, what do people do?
Well, my email address is just my name, and it's my first initial for Kevin K, and then my last name is S C H O E S S O W, and then we're doing the @wisc.edu.
There you go. So, Jeffrey, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. James in Milwaukee has something for us. James, hi.
Hi, good morning. I was kind of looking for an update on those jumping worms. I believe I identified them in my compost this past summer. And my compost heap is like 10, 15 feet away. I've got 3 20-foot raised bed gardens. And so I didn't put the compost in last fall like I normally do, and I've got quite a bit of it. And about a week ago or maybe a week and a half when it was warm, I went out and took a shovel full of it up, kind of semi-frozen. And those babies just stood right up, and they were still moving around a little bit slowly, but...
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering, what should I do with all that composted soil in there? Should I put it in those raised bed gardens, or?
So you're pretty confident that you have the jumping worm in your compost?
Well, last summer, I mean, I looked at them, looked online at the pictures, and, you know, each shovel full, there will be, you know, 50 to 100 of them sort of standing up in there, you know.
Yeah, I guess, you know, this is the unfortunate thing, and I made reference to this earlier when we have non-native and sometimes, you know, they're called invasive or really aggressive, you know, and they don't really fit into our natural ecosystem. And this is another case where, you know, this species is here. We've known about it now for several years, and this is where we have to do our due diligence to slow the spread and maintain it where it's at, and don't, you know, unintentionally spread it to your neighbors and around your property where you don't want it. So if you can keep it confined to the, you know, compost, that's a good thing. But now what do you do with all that compost, and how do you kind of sterilize that so that you're killing off the, you know, the eggs and the adults, and that in itself could be a real, you know, monumental task depending on the size of your compost, because you really have to get it, you know, sterilized with some kind of, I'm assuming, heat. I'd have to look online and figure out what is the recommendation for, you know, killing off you know, the larvae and whatnot. But, you know, I would really be hesitant to be spreading that around, and, you know, it's just a matter of how do you, you know, kill what's in that pile, and depending on the size of it, you know, you put it all in black bags and let it solarize, or do you otherwise, I really don't know. I'd have to go online and look more specific.
But I think that would probably help if you got it all in black bags and solarize it, but I'd leave it in there for a long, long time. I wouldn't be just leaving it in there a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so I would go back online and, you know, do a little bit of research on jumping worms. I typed in jumping worms, UWEX, on the computer, and there's stuff that comes up, and I'm sure in there they have recommendations on how to sterilize infected, you know, compost or soil. And I guess, you know, we just have to be cognizant that, you know, there's that risk that will always be there, and just make sure you're not sharing it too widely.
James, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, we'll get to you in just a second, but I want to remind you as you listen in that we are visiting with Kevin Chessot today. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Kevin Chessot, Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. We've zeroed in a little on soil, but we can take other questions as well. If you'd like to join in, the number's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. We've got open lines to get you on pretty quickly. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have two, I think, really short questions. I live in an apartment, so I don't have my own garden spot, and I've been able to, like, scavenge. Every year I've been able to find some field that someone is letting me plant things in. And my question is, when it rains, how careful do I really have to be about not walking on the dirt when it's wet? Because I don't want to, like, you know, ruin our soil.
Yeah,
compact it, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, compaction is the biggest concern when we have wet soils. I mean, it depends on the soil type, obviously. Heavier soils, the clay type soil, silt loam, they're much more prone to compaction, obviously, than a coarser or sandy soil. So I don't know, what kind of soil do you have?
It's pretty clayey around here.
Yeah, so, you know, you're right to be cautious about, you know, stepping where you have plants and plant materials, because you're going to be squishing out any air that might still be in those micropores, and it's just going to create a very dense layer. And once that dries out, it might actually get more like concrete. And that's where, again, we have to be thinking about, you know, soil health, and compaction is one of the things we want to avoid. And that's my reason to go to raised beds where you don't have a reason to step into the planting area. And that's just something to think about. Or if you do have to step into the bed, you know, be wary of where you're stepping, and maybe you have a stepping stone to help dissipate, you know, the compaction issues. So, yeah, definitely keep that in mind.
Does it help to have, like, a layer of mulch down between the rows? Does that help with compaction?
Most definitely. And that's what I said. If you're not set up for the raised beds and doing things by reaching in, then, you know, think about how you can protect that soil surface from compaction. And an organic mulch is a wonderful way to minimize that. You're not going to completely, you know, prevent it, but it's certainly better than stepping on bare soil, because bare soil is one of the number one things we want to avoid when we're doing our gardening, and covering the soil surface with an organic mulch. And that's where those leaves come in, especially if they've been shredded and stockpiled. Now, maybe in your situation, you don't have access to that, but you can purchase, you know, some mulches that will break down over time. I'm not a big fan of using the shredded bark and the wood chips in an annual bed, that, you know, because they don't break down.
Yeah.
And they can cause problems. But, you know, there's things you can do, newspaper maybe, or, you know, whatever you can come up with to kind of help with protecting the soil from compaction.
Sarah, does that help?
Yeah. Can I ask one other quick question? Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I have a bunch of container plants, and if the plant has been healthy, is there anything wrong with dumping the soil in, like, some guy's field?
You know, I always say know what's in it, you know, and that's just like when you purchase or you get organic materials, you know, understand the source and what are you putting in that pot? You know, maybe you're doing organic amendments, or maybe you're doing a little bit of more conventional stuff, like, you know, commercial fertilizer, Miracle-Gro, or what have you. And most of those things are fairly, you know, safe. They're going to wash out, and, you know, there's really nothing in that pot that I would think would be harmful. And you're kind of recycling it, and if it goes on the edge of that farmer's field, you know, I don't think he's going to care one way or the other, unless, of course, there's contaminants in there. you know, like a herbicide or some kind of chemical, but I doubt that's going to be the case. So, yeah, you know, just recycle.
Or wherever you find your next garden, you can just leave it there, put it there.
Yeah, I've been known when I've moved to take my soil with me. You know? So those those pots, I've got several containers alongside of my garage right now that I just combined all of my container plants and pots and dumped them into one big, you know, container, and that's where it sits all winter. And then in the spring, I dump it out, re-amend it, and then refill my containers.
Yeah, there you go. Sarah, does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Brad in Glendale, it's your turn. Hi, Brad.
Yes, I heard at the beginning of your show you said, you know, put in more mulch and more organic matter, but you said no till. And what I've done is I gather all my leaves in the fall, and then I lacerate them so they're really tiny, and then I simply put them on top of my annual beds. They stay there all winter, and then in the spring I've used a spade fork to kind of turn it into the soil. I get to the point now where when I plant, I don't even have to use like a little trowel. I simply can push my hands and dig a deep enough hole and put it in there. But are you saying that I shouldn't be turning the organic matter or compost into the soil?
No, this is, again, a general kind of, it just gets people to think about, you know, tilling and that disturbance that may happen depending on the type of gardening you're accustomed to. And, you know, again, going back to the days when I was younger and, you know, the rototiller that went up and down the rows, you know, every other week to take care of weeds and all that mechanical disturbance, that's the kind of worst case scenario. But obviously when you've got plants, you've got to get in there and do some disturbance, obviously, to plant. And what you've done, you know, probably didn't happen overnight, but you keep adding that organic mulch and organic materials over time. That soil tilth develops, it gets softer, there's more porosity, and it really doesn't take much to open that up to do your transplanting or your seeding. And, you know, you don't need to get in there and bust up anything with any major tillage. So, yes, we still need to disturb the soil, but the concept here is, you know, if we do it right, we're disturbing it very little or not much at all. And you know, that's what we're trying to achieve. And it sounds like you're definitely heading in that direction. So, no, I'm not saying don't touch the soil. But in some cases, maybe you can. You can just, you know, peel the soil back and poke your plant in there and you don't do any more.
There you go. Yeah, mm-hmm. you're doing things right, Brad. Thank you very much for calling. Molly in Rosendale, it's your turn. Hi, Molly.
Hi. This is my first time ever calling the radio station, so I'm really excited.
Oh, well, good for you. Glad you called. What's on your mind?
So this year is our second year with a no-till garden, and we made our rows last year. And we've been adding grass clippings and leaves from our yard. You know, just like brush. But I wanted to know was for this year, when we start to plant stuff, is it okay to disturb that first layer of soil on top?
Yeah, and this kind of gets back to the comments I was making with Brad, the previous caller, that, you know, there's a practicality and that, you know, good old common sense about, you know, we still need to accomplish what we need to accomplish in managing the soil and doing our planting and all those things. It's just, you know, if there's ways we can make adjustments to not overwork that soil profile, because that's the home, you know, that's the housing, if you will, for all of our soil livestock that are, you know, living in there. And sometimes, you know, if we till too much, we're breaking up some of those fungal hyphae and all those other good things that happen in the soil that associate with our plant roots. So, you know, you just have to, it's like anything, how extreme do you get in trying to achieve this ideal, you know, what we call book world versus the real world says, well, you know, I got to till, I got to get in there and have a nice seed bed. But it sounds like you're doing everything right and you'll figure things out and what works, and you know the plants will tell you if they're happy and you did very little tillage and you got a happy plant, then it's like, hey, I guess I don't have to till much.
Yeah.
So it's all in perspective.
Molly, does that help?
It does. It does. It was kind of a similar question to your last caller, but.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you called.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing the right thing. I mean, you're harvesting local sourced organic materials, and, you know, not ideally, but you can compost those and help break that down a little bit more. But, you know, why not add that material onto the soil surface and let that slowly work into the soil and build your soils up? And in the long run, you're going to be better off than if you did not do that.
Yeah. Molly, thanks again. Call again sometime. Love to hear your voice. Let's go to Louisa in Menominee next. Hi, Louisa.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I have been dealing with jumping worms up here. And I originally, when I found out we had them in a 1,500 square foot garden, talked to Bernadette Williams down at the DNR, I think she is.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. She recommended tea seed meal as one thing to do that kills the worms, and that's an organic fertilizer, actually, so it's not toxic to anything else but the worms, and it's made out of camellia seeds, ground up camellia seeds. I bought a 60-pound bag last spring, and for this 1,500 square foot garden, I made two applications. It kills the worms after they hatch out, so you have to wait until you have to watch the garden or the compost pile, and when it the worms are supposed to be killed by the winter. And the only thing that survives are the eggs. And so you have to wait for the eggs to hatch out, which might be like at the end of May up north. And then you apply the tea seed meal, and you wet it. You sprinkle it over the top of the soil. You work it in, and you water it in. And for that 1,500-square-foot garden, I used 20 pounds for one application, and then I waited until like mid-July when if there were any more eggs left, they would have possibly hatched. If I missed some, they would have hatched out. Then I did it again, and I only did it twice last year. I also followed her recommendation to work in some biochar, which has sharp little edges that will pierce the skins of the jumping worms. And regular European worms have a mucous membrane. They don't get harmed by it like the jumping worms do. I did those two things, and I reduced the jumping worms. I don't think they're completely gone. I'm just going to do the whole thing over again. And it wasn't that expensive. The biochar is also an organic amelioration of the soil that's supposed to help the soil retain more moisture. So neither of these things are toxins. But it might be, I think I had 28 worms per square foot when I first realized I had them. Last fall, I did another tally, and they were down to like 3 or 4. So I'm going to continue doing this. But it seems like the way to go, and it is working.
Sounds wonderful. And would you repeat the First Amendment that you used? What did you say? Tea seed?
It's called tea seed meal. And it's ground up camellia seeds. I bought like a 60-pound bag, and it cost about $60. So it wasn't hugely expensive, I didn't think, for the benefit of getting rid of these insidious worms.
Yeah, and tea, is it T-E-A or is it the letter T?
It's T-E-A, but it's not made out of...
Not made out of tea.
I don't know why they call it that.
Tea seed...
Meal.
Meal. Tea seed meal. Okay. Louisa, well, that sounds great, Kevin.
Well, you gotta love Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. I mean,
oh, yeah.
She's sharing with us some real-life experiences. And Bernadette is the go-to expert on this, as far as I can tell. I've met her. I've seen her programming. And, you know, again, if you go online and look up Jumping Worms, the Wisconsin DNR has a page and fact sheets that talk about all those things on identification and management and life cycles. And, you know, we need to be well informed to make good decisions. And, you know, it sounds like Louisa has done just that, and she's, you know, going to consistently keep after this. And hopefully you can eradicate them, but that's a really tough thing to do. So you just got to manage them. And by all means, don't spread that around to your neighbors if you can avoid it. And just cross your fingers that you don't have a major issue with them in the future.
Yeah. It sounds like it would be a good opportunity for our earlier caller who had the compost pile full of them. That might be something that he could use. So, Louisa,
right. Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Louisa, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very much. Well, we have Bob in Menominee with something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question. My family wants to put flowers and sunflowers in the backyard, but what do I use? Just a bag mix that I would get from the store? And then I stay in the far backyard where there's pine trees.
Oh, you're breaking up on me. So, Bob, stay listening, but we can't hear you anymore. But Bob is interested in planting some wildflowers in his backyard, maybe making... Bob, I don't know if I can still hear you. Are you trying for a whole field of wildflowers? We lost him. So on something like that, a prairie nursery, perhaps, type, go to a site like that?
Yeah, again, you know, without having Bob online or on the air here to kind of get a little bit more perspective on, you know, what is the intended goal or what are you trying to accomplish? And, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, a couple of sunflowers in the backyard versus I want more of a native, kind of like you were implying, Larry, planting of various types of flowers. But, you know, just like making any decision or planning ahead is, you know, you just have to think about what do plants need, right? They need good soil. They need access to water and sunlight, right? And, you know, if there's a lot of shade in an area, you know, that needs to be taken into account. I heard some reference of some trees in the back, perhaps. And, you know, if they're not in deep shade, most plants will be just fine. You know, and then it's just a matter of what are the varieties that you're thinking about growing and what look and how high they get. And, you know, and then you just have to, you know, figure out how do you plant them in the proper manner and with the right soil conditions. And so I guess that would be my perspective at this point.
Yeah. Knowing sorry more we details. Lost him. Yeah, that's too bad.
You know, and the bag soil that he referenced there too, you know, I don't see why you can't just go out and buy some good bag mix. Yeah. But I'm going to still go back and say, once you get the soil all prepped after you've added those amendments, you know, consider getting your soil tested just to get that information and you know where you're starting.
Yeah. Tim in Genesee Depot, it's your turn. Hi, Tim.
Well, hello, Larry. I'm listening to you guys in my kitchen while I'm cutting up rutabagas from last year's garden.
Oh, good for you.
And a shout-out to Prairie Nursery. We've got lots of we've been using Prairie Nursery plants for the past 10 years. We've got them all over the yard. But last year in our garden, we ended up planting some marigolds and some zinnias just to kind of add some color. But obviously, we noticed there were lots of bees that were flying around. Do those bees help pollinate the plants in the garden itself?
Oh, this is like a setup for, you know, diversify and biodiversity and pollinators and all those good things that are part of this ecology that comes with gardening and, you know, whether that's in our backyard or, you know, in a larger planting. So, yeah, you know, any kind of pollen source is going to attract, you know, different pollinators and those bees are going to go to other flowers that might be in your garden that need pollinating. And if you want fruit set, bees and other pollinators are super important, right? So As far as which plants are best to attract pollinators, you know, again, there's the internet. I would just go to, you know, the Xerces Society is a really good resource for pollinators and pollinator-friendly plants. But, you know, there too, pollinator-friendly plants, UW Extension or Xerces Society, you're going to get a big, long list of plants that are very specific for different types of pollinators. And the more pollinators we have flying around in our backyards, the more likely they're going to be visiting our vegetable plants that need pollinating so we get good fruit set. And that's just how nature works. We got to have, you know, both there present. And, you know, flowers are a great way to attract pollinators. And like I said, whether marigolds and zinnias are the best type of pollinator, you know, the fact that they're attracting the bees is a good thing. So
yeah,
congratulations. And, you know, again, more diversity, more flowering plants all season long is what we're looking for.
Yeah. Tim, thank you so much. Ken in Blanchardville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ken.
Well, hey, guys. I really appreciate the show.
Thank you.
And my question is, in Blanchardville, where I'm at, I've got very rocky, sandy soil. I put a shovel in, and I probably can get in about a half inch before I hit a big stone or boulder or something. So raised beds are my thing. And we've actually put in raised beds, and I got some old railroad ties for free and all that. And then I said, what an idiot. These things are soaked with creosote. And, you know, so what's the best material that I can be making raised beds out of?
Yeah, so raised beds, you know, I envision any number of, you know, scenarios with a raised bed. If you're talking, you know, like a box, like a great big planter with sides and, you know, they're maybe 2 or 3 feet tall, you know, you need some kind of container, and using, you know, railroad ties certainly provided that, but, you know, you've come to realize you want to switch. So what are the other materials? I would, you know, say, you know, any untreated wood would be my personal preference. You have to be careful with some of the treated wood products. They've changed over the years. Some of them don't have the arsenic and are technically supposed to be safer and not leaching. But if you don't want to go there and just say, I'm going to go with non-treated wood, you know, cedar is a slow rot wood, takes moisture well. You know, oak also slow rot. Black locust. I mean, there's a number of wood types that resist rot or are slow to rot, you know, versus something like, you know, a white pine. The other thing people do is they'll line the inside of their beds with what, you know, plastic? Well, what is that plastic going to leach out if you're concerned about that? But most cases, just untreated wood, 2x, you know, rough sawn even, 2x6 will get you, you know, enough strength. And, you know, again, there's designs online on how to do all this, but I would just start with untreated wood of whatever source. It can be a little expensive if you go to the cedar, but that's my preference. And then it's just how tall do they need to be, and that's going to, you know, cause the expense to go up. You know, it might be $100 or more per 4-foot by 8-foot box.
Yeah.
But they're wonderful for gardening in, because you don't have to bend over, and there's all the things that come with, you know, that confined setting, you know, where you can be very specific in managing those plants.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't have to make sides either, do you, Kevin?
No. And that's what I said. You can be as creative as you want. I mean, I've seen people, you know, who've got access to trees, whether it be a dead fall that's, you know, on their property, or they actually go and cut some, you know, green trees down and cut them up into sections, and you just throw those down on the edge, put a little stake in there to hold them in place, and now you've kind of got a 6-inch kind of edge to hold the soil in that spot. So yeah, there's a lot of different methods. Or you don't have to have sides at all. You can just have a mound and walking paths in between. You know, so it's
sure.
How formal do you need to be, and what look do you like to have? Once you put in a structure, now how do you weed around that structure if it's in a grassy area? You know, do you get the weed whip out and have to go all the way around those boxes, or, you know, mulch all the way around the boxes, and then, you know, that helps too. So, you know, you just have to, you know, think it out.
And thanks again, Ken. Appreciate your call. Kevin Schesso, our guest today, the area ag development agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Kevin Schesso, area ag development agent for UW Extension. He works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Great to have him along. You know, we got an email from Samantha, Kevin, and wanted to know the best ways to use a broad fork in general and how to use them in 4x8 raised beds.
Well, there's a new term for us, broad fork. I'm sure a bunch of people know what that is, but I'm just happy to have one because we didn't have one for many years, and it's just the really strong, large, wide pitchfork with, you know, heavy-duty tines. You can literally jump on the thing, and it goes down maybe 12 inches into the soil. And it's just got these little, you know, bars or metal edges that you can then tip back with these long handles. And it gets back to what are you trying to accomplish with that broad fork. I mean, we use our broad fork to just kind of break up that compaction that might have happened over the winter as we get into spring, maybe work up the topsoil a little bit to incorporate some organic matter. But it's a very gentle kind of tillage, and it goes down, you know, 12 inches maybe. And it's just a matter of how aggressive you want to be that with that and how convenient it is to use. Now, in a raised bed, you know, I don't know how a broad fork would work if you've got a 3-foot box and now you got to climb up there and jump on this fork, you know, versus it's just a short one that's at ground level. So broad forks are a wonderful tool because they don't do a lot of disturbance, but they do aerate it a little bit and soften up that, you know, compaction that might have occurred over the winter. So I don't know if that answers her question.
Yeah, I think that helps. Yeah.
You know, and you there too, you can go online and find them, or you go at the local garden centers and just ask them if they have any broad forks, and then you get to see what they look like and say, wow, you know, that's just what I need to do low disturbance and follow the add more till less method.
It's going to cost you a few bucks, but they last.
You'll have it for the rest of your gardening life, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's take another call, this one from Leslie in Hartford. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I have to say, I have been listening to your show for years, and I just learned so much.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I'm calling about the man that called about the raised beds, and I just wanted to chime in and say, you know, you really don't even have to build size, and I think you might have started to refer to that a little bit. I've got areas in my yard where it gets kind of low, and water will build up, and you'll have standing water after a lot of rain and stuff. And so I built up my beds using the lasagna method and just keep building them over the years. And, you know, it looks more like just, well, as your producer was saying, little berms.
Yeah.
And it's more like landscaping than it is having boxes around. It raises them out of the water. This man had a lot of stone a few inches down in his property. And, you know, even if you bring it up 6, 8, 10 inches, you've got a lot of dirt there for these roots to mature in and even work their way down, you know, around those other stones. I guess it depends on what a person wants to achieve and how they want their property to look, but I thought I'd just add that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And that can be very attractive. Kevin?
Oh, yes, and this is again another great example of, you know, wonderful Garden Talk listeners sharing their experiences, because there's lots and lots of different ways to do things. And, you know, the disadvantage of using a box is you've got this hardscape now, and what does that mean? And, you know, that's different for everybody. You know, those tall 3-foot boxes, are wonderful for people who have maybe some disability issues or can't get down, you know, low to the ground. So it's, again, what is the ultimate goal in doing raised beds? And, you know, like Leslie said, if it's just to provide a little bit more of an artificial soil layer above that rocky clay subsoil material, you can do that just by mounding, and then you can shape those. They can have curves. You can mulch beds around, you know, walking paths. You can get as creative as you want. And, you know, 5 years from now, if you wanted to just start over, you could, you know, just wipe the slate clear and redesign something different.
Yeah.
You know, because there's no...
Why not?
Yeah, there's no, like, big boulders. There's no, you know, hardscapes in there to move around. It's just organic material.
Or mow around.
Or more, right? That's that whole concept of sustainable landscaping, and that all this all connects, right? You know, this is not just one size fits all.
Yeah. Leslie, thank you again. I appreciate your call very much. Well, let's go to Tom in Menominee Falls next. Hi, Tom.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. I got two questions. I have two areas in the backyard I put plants in every year that I start in the basement. About 20 by 20, and we're allowed to burn in Menominee Falls, so I keep that ashes. Does it hurt to put some of that ashes in the garden?
Not at all, except, right? There's always that except or depends. You know, I always say, just like with purchasing or using other organic materials, know the source. Where is that wood ash coming from? And if you feel, if you're in control of it, and you know what goes in that furnace or that outdoor boiler or, you know, firebox, and if it's nothing but, you know, just normal kind of wood-like materials, doesn't have glues and formaldehydes and, you know, used oil and any other contaminants, you know, go ahead, use it. It's a wonderful amendment. Obviously, the potash is going to be in the ashes, but the other thing that it has is it's got free carbonates, and the carbonates will help reduce the acidity in your soil. So it's a wonderful liming material. There's other minerals in there, you know, calcium and magnesium and some micronutrients in there as well. So it's a good source of nutrition for the soil. But I would caution that if you do too much of it, you can actually bring that pH above 7, and that's where we have to say, wait a minute, I should not be doing this so much. So that's where that soil test comes in. So, yeah, wood ashes are a wonderful thing to do.
And, Tom, thanks very much for calling. And let's take another call. Adam in Deerfield. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question. I hope I'm not repeating somebody else's. I wasn't listening the entire time. But and we've done a lot of the same things that you've talked about. We have raised beds. We do our composting and reusing organic matter from the leaves and a little bit of the grass clippings, and it's worked out extremely well. But I had a question. We have a farm down the way that has a sign up for free manure compost, and we talked about possibly adding that to the leaf pile that we have breaking down and increasing our nutrient content for that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it kind of gets back to the comment, as long as you understand the source and where it's coming from, and whenever you bring in animal manures, with the exception perhaps of poultry, you're very likely going to be bringing in potential weed seeds in particular, and that can be like the Achilles heel or I really would love to add more of this, but I'm just bringing in all these weed seeds. So that's the probably biggest caution. There's nothing beats a good composted animal manure. It has lots of benefits, and to mix it in with all that carbon of your leaves is going to help break that stuff down, and you're going to end up with a much better product in the end. So there too, I would maybe test, you know, take a small amount of it and work with it and test it and see. Or, you know, maybe just see what kind of weeds might be germinating from that. But it's going to be variable, and you don't know how that pile is this year versus next year. And, you know, so it's a gamble. But I would say if you do it right, you'll benefit more than not. And again, it just goes back to that whole concept of adding more, again, within reason, but that manure is going to be really good nitrogen source to mix with that carbon in the leaves. So
yeah.
I would take advantage of it, but just do it, you know, like you've done before. Do it very carefully and with some thought, and do a little testing on the side, or don't just, you know, bring in five pickup loads and then you realize, boy, I wish I wouldn't have done that.
I've got five pickup loads of weeds or something.
Well, right. You know,
yeah.
And there's no guarantees. You just got to, it just comes with the deal.
And thanks, Adam, very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kevin Shesso, our guest today. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He works with master gardeners in the Tri-County area, does a lot of teaching as well. Our guest for Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller. Listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. It's been a lot of fun talking today with Kevin Shesso. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for the Tri-County area, manages the teaching and display gardens at the Spooner Ag Research Station, and organizes horticulture workshops and field days, among other things. And he's certainly happy to answer your questions as we move along today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. John in Appleton, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I've been using raised beds since the 80s, and one of the inherent problems with them is water will flow through them, and they dry out faster than what you would in a normal garden situation. And so the last raised bed that I reworked mine, I dug all the dirt out of mine, and it was treated lumber, and I lined my raised bed with rubber roofing membrane. And I left a high spot, a ridge running right down the center, and that spot is open. And so if we do get a lot of rain, it can hold down in the bottom, but if you get enough of it, it will flow out through that opening in the ridge. And that way I was able to, I heavied up my soil a little bit to help retain water, and as a result, I don't require as much water.
Hmm. Interesting. Kevin, what do you think?
Again, more creative gardening, all because of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, right? So, yeah, that is, again, you know, there's always pros and cons with any of these practices. And John's right, you know, a raised bed area is got more exposure to the elements, and it's just like a pot, you know. Again, depending on the size and height and all those things. But, yeah, it's going to probably dry out quicker. Now, if you're on a wet site, that's a good thing. But, you know, if you got to maintain enough moisture to grow your plants, then you got to take that into account. So sometimes people will put drip emitters and have all that set up in some of their raised beds just to account for that drying that happens with it. But, you know, anything we can do to manage that water, and it sounds like John has got creative with lining the boxes that he's got.
Yep.
So that the water, it's almost like having an artificial subsoil aquifer or reservoir there for the roots, because you know they'll find it, they'll go down and use that water, and you know why not?
Why not? Thank you, mm-hmm. John, appreciate it. Mary emailed to say the latest issue of Handyman magazine has a great article on building a raised bed, so that's Handyman magazine. Peter in Madison, he emailed to say he uses plastic decking boards, often available cheaply as damaged So if you've got some damaged ones at the big box stores, they're 12 feet long. He uses one board high, about 6 inches high. Five boards at 12 inches high gives you two beds, 12 by 3, for about $20.
There you go, Larry. I mean, there's just a lot of different ways to get creative, and recycling, it all fits into this whole, you know, composting stuff we've been talking about, recycling organic matter. Why not recycle, other construction materials or any number of things, you know, pallets. I mean, there's just, it's an endless of when you think about what you can do to accomplish what you need to. And again, just like all this, is keep in mind, you know, what that recycled product may contain. If it's a concern to you, maybe you don't want to use it. But, you know, everybody's different. And what Peter explained is another great example of just how to get creative. And it doesn't have to be expensive.
No.
It really doesn't.
Maddie and DePere called to ask if you put manure in a pile and let it sit for a year, will it kill the weeds?
Well, probably not. Weeds have evolved.
The weed seeds, yeah.
The weed seeds have evolved to survive, and we know from all kinds of research and studies that some of those weed seeds will remain viable for, you know, hundreds of years, and you just don't know, you know, how long it takes for them to die naturally. That's where the, you know, the heating and the solarizing comes in, because that's bringing the temperature up above a more normal kind of evolutionary temperature, and that's when you can start to reduce that. So just letting it sit, unless, of course, you know, the weeds germinate, and then you pull them, and then they germinate again, and you pull them, you know, there probably are always going to be some viable seeds left over. And that's where you've got to pay attention to that temperature with the, you know, the hotter composting, or maybe you cover them, you know, with black plastic and again try to solarize it. So, yeah, I wouldn't trust that just letting it sit for a year is going to eliminate weed seeds.
You know, we had a caller earlier, pretty early in the show actually, who was talking about some a new property that he bought, and he had some blueberry-like plants growing, and wondered what they were. And Darcy emailed to say it might be native huckleberry. That's a possibility.
Okay.
Maybe native huckleberry on those blueberry-like plants. So that earlier caller could go online, take a look at native huckleberry, and see if they match up. John in Greenfield, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, relative to buckthorn and invasive species, here in Greenfield, we have a reserve which has 150-year-old oak trees on it. And unfortunately, over the last 5-6 years, we've gotten a buckthorn invasion in there, which is literally taking over. My question is relative to how much damage might this do to the oaks? And secondly, is there anything we can do now, short of chemical intervention, that will eradicate that plant?
Wow.
Again, I would always kind of like to defer some of the expertise that you can find online. And the Wisconsin DNR has a bunch of information on invasive plants, and buckthorn being one of the more noted and primary species that we're battling, if you will. And, you know, I always like to remind people, you know, you can't control nature, you can only manage it. And in this case, you know, depending on how much time and energy and resources, and then again, you know, who owns the property, who has final say on, you know, doing this, and you need an army of volunteers to come in and try to, you know, reduce the impact that this buckthorn is having. So we do know that, you know, anytime there's competition, you probably are going to be out competing, you know, other plant species that may be more appropriate for that site. And that's where we get this, you know, out of balance. Again, if you're trying to approach, you know, some historical background, you know, community of plants where the buckthorn, you know, out competes that with shade and, you know, all the other competition that comes with a real dense understory like that. So definitely the more open we can keep the area so that those more native plants can thrive, the better. When it comes to competition for those oaks, yes, they're probably competing for nutrients and water. And in a more natural environment, you probably don't have that much understory. So, you know, but a large 100-plus-year-old oak tree, I can only imagine it's got enough root system to kind of compensate for that, unless, of course, you get into a really droughty stress situation. You know, it might not be able to compete as well. But my guess is that those oak trees are going to be okay. But certainly if we can reduce that competition by removing some of them, why not?
Yeah, it takes a lot of work if you're not using a chemical to just keep hacking those down.
Yeah, yep. And that's where, you know, you can go to, you know, these websites. And, you know, I like to, again, go with our state agencies or university sources for information, because they typically acknowledge that there's many options for management. And chemical is one, non-chemical is another. And what does that look like, and how do you go about it?
How do you go about it?
Yep.
Well, Tom in Appleton has something relating, so let's go there. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Larry. Yeah, I would just say the short answer for that caller is no. Without chemicals, you will not control a buckthorn invasion. But you don't need much chemical. You do the cut, treat, or cut stump method. You would be out there this time of year or a big window of time, and you'd be applying a tiny bit of the appropriate herbicide to the cut surface. I know you guys know about this. But for that caller, it's not a huge amount of chemical, and you're getting rid of the plant. And then you do follow up the next year with a foliar spray, because you can have all kinds of seeds sprouting. And then we found that whereas old literature said that buckthorn seeds last 7 years, 10 years, we're finding about 3 years, and then they're done. So it's not quite as grim as it used to seem, but it is really tough.
Yeah, Tom. Yep. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. No, that's good to point out that, you know, there's always hope, right? And I would agree. You know, if you know what you're doing and you follow label directions or look at, you know, what other people are saying as far as being successful, yeah, we can work through these challenges.
We have, and thanks again, Tom. I appreciate your call. You know, I mentioned at the start of the show that you always have events that are going on that relate to gardening and your neck of the woods. What have you got going on?
Yeah, and again, you know, my neck of the woods being northwestern Wisconsin, because that's kind of my area that I work in. But the very first one that I'd like to remind people is that we have active Master Gardener groups all over the state, and this is a time of year where a lot of those Master Gardener groups are putting on some kind of spring gardening expos or gardening seminars. So the Barron County Master Gardeners are holding their annual spring expo on Saturday, April 6th, and it's an all-day event. I don't have the specifics on who I think John Dwyer is going to be there as one of their speakers, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. You can, again, go online and find information for that. I do an annual grape pruning workshop out in our teaching and display garden, and we have two rows of grapes, about 60 plants, three different training systems that I demonstrate grape pruning and grape training on, and I do that on Saturday, and this year it's April 13th, again at the Spooner Ag Research Station. I also am following in the footsteps of, and I don't know, Larry, if you remember Dr. Bob Tomisch.
Oh, yeah.
My mentor in a lot of this, and I'm happy that I was able to get his tutelage. But I learned all about apple grafting from Dr. Tomisch, and so I've kind of taken that up again locally and providing that as an option. So on April 4th, it's a Thursday night, I'm going to be doing an apple grafting workshop at the Spooner Ag Research Station. It's like $20 to cover all the costs of the course. But so that's those three events. And then, of course, our local Master Gardener Association is doing their Master Gardener Volunteer Training, which starts March 26th.
Oh, so lots going on. And with Master Gardeners all over the state, I'm sure there's lots of events going on, aside from the ones you mentioned, that practically every area of the state's probably got something going on with Master Gardeners right now. And Bob Tomisch was a regular guest on this program for a long time. And, of course, he passed away several years back now, but we certainly miss him, and he was a wonderful guest. I remember once when he was on the show, somebody called from Germany to ask a question. They were listening online. Bob was a great guy. You can join in, too, by the way, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sarah from Columbia called in. She recommended the buckthorn baggie for helping kill buckthorn. It's another one I don't know much about, Kevin. But
yeah, I think basically, again, you know, it's at what lengths do we want to go to do this, you know, non-chemically. And basically, the way I understand it is it's just a black bag that you put over the cut stump. And, you know, you're starving that stump of light, and it maybe inhibits or prevents the sprouts from coming up. I don't know. I don't have any personal experience with it, but I think that's, you know, there may be more to it, but I think that's maybe the direction that they're going with that.
I didn't really know anything about buckthorn baggies. I'm amazed. Well, I probably knew something and forgot about it. I forget. Once in a while, I forget those things. There's a lot of good information that comes across this program, and I learn a lot, but I don't always retain everything. Well, let's give our callers a chance to join in again at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And I see Jill Nadeau is getting some callers up. So we will go to the phones in just a second. I think there may be a Creeping Charlie question coming your way, Kevin. Michael in Oconomowoc. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, yeah, I just have a quick question. Is any ideas on Creeping Charlie? I got some on the edge. We kind of live on slightly edge of a forest that's on the eastern edge in grasslands, and then I have some Creeping Charlie that's been creeping around the backyard, and I try to pull it out some, and now some's getting on the north side of our house, too. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Well, this is another one of those very common questions because it's a creeping, you know, vining plant, just like the name implies, and it's very competitive. It will crowd out other plants, and you'll end up with this kind of, you know, monoculture almost of Creeping Charlie and not much else. Maybe you throw some moss in there, too, and, you know, so it kind of gets back to that question is, you know, why might you want to manage it? And, you know, what's the goal in doing that? And a lot of times it's because we have the perception that we want to have a nice monoculture of grass, maybe different types of grass in there, but those, you know, blades of grass contrast to the Creeping Charlie broadleaf, and it stands out as something that, you know, gets our attention. So that's a lot of times our motivation to managing weeds in a lawn, is that there's that contrast between a broadleaf and a grass. So Creeping Charlie is kind of the king of yeah. that contrast, and it's a very, very aggressive, and, you know, it's a very common thing to do. And so now we're getting back to what is the goal in trying to manage it. And there are chemicals, and there are non-chemical approaches, and it's just a matter of, you know, if you have a small enough patch, you can do spot treatments and other ways to, you know, try to knock that Creeping Charlie back, but we really want to enhance that competition from the grass. So, you know, that's where if your soil tests or your pH or other things aren't favorable for the grass, the Creeping Charlie is going to have an advantage as well. So, again, you know, I hate to always just say go online and look up stuff, but, you know, there's any number of options for managing it. You know, I've heard you put borax and boron, and, you know, you can kind of set it back that way, or maybe, you know, other, you know, home remedies. And there, too, you know, just beware of unintended consequences. And me personally, I don't get too excited about having, you know, some of these multiple species in my yard. Adds to the biodiversity. There's flowers that are on the Creeping Charlie that might attract pollinators that are beneficial for other plants in your yard. So, you know, I'm not telling you not to control it, but just think about the pros and cons.
And Creeping Charlie's one of the first, or maybe the first things to flower in the spring. So for insects that are going to come, bees or whatever that are going to come, they've got a food source right there.
Well, again, you know, pros and cons. You know, and you just have to decide, is it worth it? And for some people, it is, because they just feel that it's something that they want to do.
Well, the lawn guys tell me that, lawn people tell me that if you keep your lawn in really good, you know, you fertilize and follow, and you cutting height to 3 to 4 inches and do a good job of caring for the lawn, it'll outcompete Creeping Charlie. At the same time, as you and I both know, if you've got a tree shading out the grass so it's not as thick as it could be, you're going to have creeping. You may well have Creeping Charlie come into play. Mm-hmm. By the way, Susan from Fredonia wanted to let us know that goats take care of buckthorn, and that is true. Goats, there are people out there who rent their goat herds out for cleaning up all kinds of things, and Creeping Charlie is something they seem to like. Or, I'm sorry, buckthorn is something they seem to like a lot.
Well, wouldn't that be interesting to have goats in the city chewing on Creeping Charlie?
not Creeping Charlie, buckthorn.
I know. Yep.
And I'm amazed they love buckthorn because it's got all those needle-like.
Well, goats. I know anybody who's raised goats know they're very good at browsing. And they really seek out some of these plants that other species don't. And there's that biocontrol option. And there, too, if we know how to go about it and we have access to, that goat farmer who's willing to bring out, a half a dozen goats into this property, but now how do you keep them contained, And that's where they come in. That's their job. Maybe they put up temporary fencing and let the goats do their thing and knock the plants back, and then you come back and maybe do some other management to just keep those plants suppressed. Yeah, so goats certainly are an option.
And apparently they seem to like it, Creeping Charlie. They'll go to, I'm Creeping Charlie. Why do I keep saying that? Buckthorn. They like it, so they keep going to the buckthorn in patches, even if there are other plants in there. Well, I've said Creeping Charlie too many times, I guess, today, Kevin, so it's probably time for me to leave, and I guess that'll mean it's time for you to leave as well. Thank you so much for being with us today. It was really a lot of fun. You do, I'll tell you what, those folks in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties are lucky to have you, and I hope you'll be back with us again.
Oh, it's always my pleasure, Larry. Look forward to it, and I do what I can, right?
Well, you do a great job. Kevin Chesso, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He'll be back. We'll do it again with him. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at rare seeds, how they're located and developed, and how you can grow them. So I hope you can join us for that next Friday at 11 or Saturday morning at 6, right here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.